The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We have so much to get to on today's program. Later on, we'll be talking about the solar eclipse that stretches across America later today. Today marks the first solar eclipse to darken so much of America in almost 40 years. So this is a once-in-a-generation occurrence, more than a generation, in fact. Today we'll continue also with what we've been discussing in several programs over the past week, the truth about Antifa. On Tuesday of last week, you'll recall President Trump was universally condemned for saying that there was violence on both sides in that tragedy in Charlottesville. And after he made those remarks, well, we've seen one story after another emerge, revealing that there was indeed violence on both sides. I mean, the New York Times has confirmed it. CNN has confirmed it. We'll see that a little bit later. And we'll look at a few reports and sound bites that will shed light on this violent movement. Also, Friday was our highest day of traffic at thetrumpet.com all year. I mean, that was our best day of the year. Last week was the best week of traffic we've had all year, and coming up later in the program, I'll explain why we had such a big spike in traffic at the website. It's pretty amazing. You won't want to miss those details. And also, if we have some time at the end, we'll get into some of the feedback that we've been getting from you in recent days in response to the program, and also to the daily email briefs that we send out. The Trumpet Brief, if you'd like to subscribe to that, you can get that daily email newsletter at thetrumpet.com. Well, over the weekend in the United States, six police officers were shot, two of them murdered in Florida. Four policemen were shot just in the state of Florida, two more state troopers up in Pennsylvania. And I'm guessing that you probably did not even notice that in the news, or if you did, it was probably just a brief report. Six law enforcement officials shot. This according to Associated Press yesterday. It says a police officer in Florida died from his injuries Saturday, a day after his colleague was killed when a suspect fired at them during a scuffle while they were on patrol. It says sheriff's deputies with a neighboring law enforcement agency later tracked Miller, that's the perpetrator. They tracked him down at a bar and approached him. And here again, he was reaching for his gun, just to paraphrase, and he was going to kill more policemen. But he was wrestled to the ground and then handcuffed and taken away. That AP report says that Miller, the killer, he had made threats to law enforcement on Facebook and other social media sites. And we'll look more at that here in just a second. But first, a word here about these two policemen. One of them, Baxter, the last name is Baxter, 27. He had been with the Kissimmee Police Department for 3 years. He was married to another police officer, and they had four children together. He was in his 20s and had four kids. Howard, the other victim, 36 years of age, served with the Kissimmee Police Department for 10 years, and he and his wife have one child. And so it quotes someone from the police department as saying that these were just two wonderful men, family men, in fact, committed to doing it the right way, it was said. Two wonderful family men in their 20s and 30s, gunned down in cold blood. The AP report says, separately, two other officers were injured late Friday in Jacksonville, Florida, after police responded to reports of an attempted suicide at a home where the mother of the man's child, their 19-month-old toddler, the woman's mother, and a family friend were thought to be in danger. One of the officers was shot in both hands, and the other was shot in the stomach. You had this together with the two state troopers who were shot in Pennsylvania. This was a short report that played on, I believe it was Fox News, clip 9.
As you know, there was a spate of police shootings today, including this one in Florida, and authorities in Florida are now saying that a second officer has died. This is a day after he and a colleague were shot during a scuffle with a suspect. The Kissimmee Police Department says that Sergeant Sam Howard died Saturday from his injuries. His colleague, that was Officer Matthew Baxter, died Friday night after the attack in the neighborhood, and this was located south of the theme park hub of Orlando. The police chief said on Saturday that Everett Miller was arrested several hours after the shootings late Friday night. But what's your reaction to this?
You know, well, listen, my heart is very heavy. I mean, police have the hardest job in the world. They have a job where it requires them to make split-second decisions that could end their life or force them to take another life. Even when I was in the military, there was nothing that was split second about that. But when I was in policing, everything I did was split second. And, you know, it's saddening that in this country, people are more concerned when police take action against a suspect than they are when a police officer is killed. If the roles were reversed here, I think we would already be seeing outrage. We would already be seeing protests, hashtags, you name it. We'd be seeing that. But no one wants to take into account the dangers of policing and how hard that job is. It's the only job in this country where you can leave home and not know if you're going to return home from work.
That's from a Fox News report. She's interviewing Vincent Hill there. He's, as you mentioned, he's a former military man, a former police officer himself, a black man who's saying, look, it's sad here that people are more concerned when police take action, when they take action against a suspect, a drug dealer, a murderer, a robber, a rioter, than they are when a police officer gets gunned down in cold blood. These two didn't even have time to react. They just went into this drug-infested neighborhood to try to eliminate or at least to slow down the advance of crime. And this killer pulled a gun out and shot both of them, killed them both right on the spot. The Orlando Sentinel, the newspaper, it says this about the murderer. It says, a Facebook page believed to be Miller's is filled with posts expressing anger over racism, slavery, and the KKK. It says in one post, he shared a meme encouraging people to shoot back with a photo of Martin Luther King Jr. So he has these grievances, all of this anger about racism and the KKK, and what possibly could have influenced Miller to think like this? What is it that's motivating him to tell others that read his Facebook page to shoot back? Could it be the wall-to-wall coverage the media gives to ragtag groups like the skinheads and the white supremacists that descended upon Charlottesville last weekend? Really, that's what they are. I mean, when you just look at the numbers. And yet, wall-to-wall coverage. And yet, why so little coverage when law enforcement officials are being gunned down right and left? Six in a weekend. Six policemen in a weekend. That man, Vincent Hill, he's right. The media are far more concerned about police taking action against a suspect, or a black suspect, to be more precise, than they are when police officers are killed. As it is, I mean, it happens. It happened over the weekend, and it hardly got any coverage, except maybe down in Central Florida. If you're not from Florida, you might not have even heard this story. Well, last week, as you know, if you listen to this program, we were talking about the media and how that rather than focusing on just this appalling spread of hatred and violence, all that they're consumed with is attacking a president of the United States. for supposedly sympathizing with the far right, sympathizing with white supremacists of all people, sympathizing with the KKK. I mean, that's the way you have to take the reporting. That's what's said. That's certainly what's implied. It doesn't matter how many times a president condemns these white nationalist movements by name. It doesn't matter. He could say it over and over again, like he did during the campaign, till he's blue in the face. And still, nothing will satisfy the leftist media. Nothing. Nothing. And then the fact that he would come out and say, well, you know, those on the far left, the alt-left, as he called them last Tuesday, they too are guilty of violence. And boy, that infuriated the radical left all the more. And the reason for that is because the mainstream media, in many ways, agree. They agree with the anarchist movements. Those movements like Antifa, or Antifa, I guess is now the way you pronounce. You get both. Look at Boston, though, over the weekend. They had the big protest. There was the build-up to them, I guess the noontime protest with these free speech activists. And then the tens of thousands of demonstrators that turned out to counter the protest. And the New York Times says that they were emboldened by recent events, like in Charlottesville. So they came out in droves to denounce racism, to denounce white supremacy, to denounce Nazism. And they were loud and boisterous. And it's not just Boston. Over the weekend, there were rallies in Hot Springs, Arkansas, Dallas, Houston, Memphis, New Orleans. But Boston, it drew the biggest crowd. 40,000 people, the New York Times estimates. 40,000. Now, Boston, to its credit, had its police officers out in full force. And so, for the most part, there were 35 arrests, something like that. But there wasn't anywhere near the kind of violence that we saw the weekend before in Virginia. The New York Times says here, a rally to promote free speech was brief and unamplified beyond the small bandstand where it was held. The event, whose participants appeared to number only in the dozens. This is the New York Times. So there were a few dozen free speech activists, okay? I mean, these aren't even skinheads or neo-Nazis. So far as I can tell, there wasn't that much in the major media about them. But this was hardly the kind of group that you saw the weekend before. A few dozen. And it says here that effort they had to set up this rally was undercut by police planning and starved by an enormous buffer zone between the handful of protesters and the overwhelming numbers of their opponents. So you have a few dozen on the one hand, and you have tens of thousands on the other coming from the far left. Certainly not all of them, Antifa, I wouldn't say, but certainly in support of that message that the media this past week has been giving credibility to. Let me play you another short clip. This is from a report on just the disparity in the size of these two protest groups. This is clip number one.
As the free speech rally ended today, witnesses tell me they were actually brought out by Boston police and assisted in getting through the huge counter protests that had come here today, actually put in wagons and safely taken away through the streets of Boston as counter protesters gathered around. Really an amazing sight today to see these two groups. The free speech rally was far, far smaller than the enormous counter protest that came here to Boston today.
So something like, I guess the New York Times says 40,000. I saw some other reports, 20 or 30,000. But it says here in that New York Times piece, organizers of the speech rally had said that they were appealing to libertarians. These are the few dozen. They were appealing to libertarians, conservatives, traditionalists, classical liberals, Trump supporters, and anyone else who enjoys their right to free speech. So as I say, not skinheads or neo-Nazis, but those that were appealing or trying to appeal to more traditionalists, classical liberals, Trump supporters. The Times says the free speech rally, which had been scheduled to run from noon until 2, concluded about 12:50 p.m. Mr. Evans, who said the event ended early by mutual agreement between the authorities and the event's organizers, said the police had helped the demonstrators get into police wagons as part of a prearranged exit strategy. So the few dozen that were there were escorted out after like 45 minutes in these police wagons. This is how the Boston police chief explained the event on Saturday, clip two.
We basically wanted them separated. And I'm sorry to report, we did have some bottles thrown at our officers that did have urine in it. A couple of our officers were hit with that. They were hit with a lot of stuff today, and I'm very proud of the job they did, and it goes to the professionalism of this department. So I'm not getting into anything. I'm real proud of the people, the way they came and stood up for hatred and bigotry, and I'm more proud of the way my officers handled that crowd.
Commissioner, the organizer of the free speech rally says that they plan to do a longer program, but the police shut that program down. Is that accurate?
No, not to my knowledge. You know what? They came in here. We made it clear. They had their speakers. I think they knew 20,000 people were approaching. And so that was you know, mutual agreed that they would get into the wagons. And we used the wagons to just get them out. So
they said some of this.
So the police chief there says that they didn't shut down the protest prematurely. Those few dozen, they knew. This is what the police chief says. They knew that 20,000 people were approaching, and so they mutually agreed, the police and the free speech activists, to get out of there in these police wagons. Notice there that the police strategy was not to keep the counter-protesters in line, but rather to create this huge buffer zone and then to get the free speech advocates out of there before it turned ugly. And at the beginning of his statement, you heard there that bottles full of urine were thrown at the officers. That's coming from Antifa. That has been widely reported at so many of these Antifa protests across the country. He says, I'm sorry to say that, but we were hit. Well, actually, we were hit by a lot of stuff. But I'm proud. I'm proud of the police officers, and I'm proud of the counter-protesters, he says, because they stood up to bigotry. That's the party line. I mean, that's what everyone has to say. You can't criticize the violent left. But there's plenty of criticism, even for a few dozen people that are there evidently to promote free speech. It's pretty amazing, even coming from the police chief himself. Where were the bottles and the flying objects coming from? Well, you look, as I said at the top of the program, you look at some of the reporting. Just since President Trump said there was violence on both sides, and you've had this piece at The Atlantic, although I think that one was written before Charlottesville. Last week you had the piece coming out from the New York Times. And then this one yesterday, CNN. CNN. The original title of this piece yesterday at CNN was "Unmasking the Leftist Antifa," Antifa movement. It says "Activists Seek Peace Through Violence." That was the original title. And then somewhere during the course of yesterday, CNN came and reduced that down to just "Unmasking the Leftist Antifa Movement." They took out "Activists Seek Peace Through Violence." And you know why they took that out? Well, you can look at this piece at CNN and scroll down to the bottom and see what they said themselves. This story, CNN says, this story has been updated to clarify that counter-protesters say they are not to blame for the violence at the Charlottesville protest. The story's headline has also been updated. That's what the note at the bottom of the article says. Well, we changed our title. We've revised the text just a little bit because the counter-protesters say they're not the ones to blame for the violence. You can't get that wrong by suggesting that we're here to promote violence, when in fact they say it over and again. Yes, we're here to be violent, to take this fight to the streets. And yet here is CNN bowing to the pressure coming from the radical left. If they say it, after all, well, it has to be the honest truth because, well, they're standing up to Nazis. So how could they be wrong? You look at that original title, and, I mean, even that, at least it suggested that there's a problem with the way Antifa's going about this. But then you read the article, you consider how it is they went about changing the title, and it's quite obvious that even though it's a fairly revealing piece, and there's video along with it, I'll play some of that in just a second, but even still, it's pretty obvious that CNN is sympathetic to the movement. CNN sees the movement as at least partially justified in its quest to seek peace through violence. That you can see if you read between the lines, if you pick up on the tone. Still, though, just like with the New York Times piece on Friday, I mean, it's revealing. It's revealing. Let me just play for you a portion of the video that's embedded in this CNN report from yesterday on Antifa, clip 5.
It's 6 a.m. in Portland, Oregon, and we're headed to a bar with blacked out windows.
They wanted to meet us really early in the morning because they're concerned about a lot of people being around.
We are meeting members of the Rose City Antifa, short for anti-fascist. This group's main goal is to disrupt neo-Nazis and white supremacists, but also take on government and capitalism.
Antifa is any group that's willing to stand up against fascists by any means necessary.
By any means necessary, they say, can mean outing a white nationalist at their work or to their neighbors. Or, as we've seen recently, violence, fires, property damage, hand-to-hand combat at protests across the country.
Explain to me the reasoning behind fighting.
You have to make it so unpalatable to be doing white supremacist organizing that they no longer want to do that. And historically, that's what's worked. You have to put your body in the way, and you have to make it speak in a language that they understand, and sometimes that is violence.
What about people who will say that it is their right to free speech, even if it's hate speech?
But we do think that communities have the right to step in and say, no, this is not acceptable in our community. We will not stand for this.
So there's an element of distrust of the government here, right? An element maybe of anarchism?
People in our group come from across the left spectrum. We have people that are anarchists, we have people that are socialists, we even have people that are like liberals or social democrats.
One of the principles is that you're not going to wait for the government to act.
We don't rely on the cops or the courts to do the work for us.
There's no firm number on how many Antifa activists there are in the U.S. because there isn't any one organization. Most are local groups that recruit and communicate through social media. But experts who track these organizations say their membership is growing in response to the rise of white national groups and the election of President Donald Trump.
And so, like we covered all through last week, their numbers are growing because of the rise of the white nationalists, the way they see it. And of course, the election of Donald Trump, more than any other single factor, the election of Donald Trump has given rise to this movement. And as you hear there, they are taking matters into their own hands. They are meeting, the way they see it, they are meeting violence with violence. And while they'll admit to the fact that they bring violence to this fight, they insist that they didn't start it. And so they tell CNN, you revised your piece to make sure it reflects the fact that we didn't start this violence. We're just responding to it. We're just reacting to it. And along the way, our goal is not just to disrupt the neo-Nazi groups. We're here to take on government. We're here to bring down capitalism. Is that disturbing? Evidently not to most members in the major media. They're playing with fire. They're encouraging it. They're stoking it. In the written piece, it says here, and their methods are often violent. That's CNN writing about Antifa. Donald Trump made the mistake last Tuesday of saying, you know what? They're violent too. Here's CNN. Their methods are often violent. Antifa leaders admit they're willing to physically attack anyone who employs violence against them or who condones racism as long as force is used in the name of eradicating hatred. It's okay, I guess, for CNN to point this out belatedly. Force is fine. Physical force is fine as long as it's used to eradicate hatred. And how do we define hatred? Well, that's up to the mob. That's up to the mob. It could be skinheads. It could be white supremacist groups. It could be someone who voted for Trump. It could be someone who's wearing an Israeli flag. They decide. If they see it as hate, they confront it with violence. That's what they say. CNN says over the past year, Antifa members have been involved in clashes across the country and the world, including Chicago, Philadelphia, Houston, Alabama, and Nebraska, and at the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany. So the movement is gaining in popularity, and it has the tacit support of the major media in the United States. Here's the rest of that video segment embedded into the CNN piece, clip 6.
Violence and property destruction led to more than 200 arrests in Washington, D.C. on Inauguration Day. Prosecutors say they were wearing masks covered head to toe in black, a tactic the Antifa call black block.
People dress in black block for a few things. One,
Scott Crow has been leading anarchist and militant leftist groups for decades.
So people put on the masks so that we can all become anonymous. And then therefore we are able to move more freely and do what we need to do, whether it is illegal or not.
So some people will push back on that and say that the black block is to keep people from being identified and arrested when they break the law, when they commit crime.
It's a good way to avoid the ramifications of law enforcement.
It's also to avoid the far-right groups they're fighting and the harassment that each side often engages in. We saw that firsthand at a May Day protest in New York City.
We cover our face because the Nazis will try to find out who we are. And that is a very bad thing because they harass people. They're the ones. They say that we're the evil ones. And you guys in the media, you always tell us, oh, they're trying to fight for their free speech. We're trying to stop them from organizing. We're not trying to stop them from their free speech. Because when they organize, they kill people, they hurt people, they fight people. And we're the ones who are fighting back. They are the second coming of Hitler.
Police in Berkeley told us they haven't seen this kind of destruction since the 1960s. Law enforcement in other cities are dealing with similar situations. Like in Portland, Oregon, where Antifa have been involved in at least 10 protests ending in violence, according to police. And it's wearing on the community.
It is new. It's like this rumble mentality of, I'm going to bring my friends, you bring your friends, and we're going to fight it out in the park. It's not something we've seen here. It's not good for the city. People are just frustrated by it. It's affecting their livability. It's affecting their business.
Has it become more violent?
It happens quicker. The fire starting that we saw on May Day is something we haven't really seen much of in the past. The running through the street, breaking windows and everything in sight. We haven't seen it as consistently as we've seen it in the last 8 months.
In the 1990s, protesters used black bloc tactics during the Seattle World Trade Organization protests. And in the 2010s, the Occupy Wall Street movement.
What they're trying to do now is not only become prominent through violence at these high-profile rallies, but also to reach out through small meetings and through social networking to cultivate disenfranchised progressives who heretofore were peaceful.
But it's the violence that's gotten them attention, directly confronting groups that preach white nationalist rhetoric, like on Inauguration Day, when white nationalist Richard Spencer was punched in the face. And it was the Antifa movement that caused Berkeley to cancel speeches by extreme right provocateurs like Milo Yiannopoulos.
Violence is a necessary part of their message because they believe that elites are controlling the government and the media. So they need to make a statement head on against people who they regard as racist.
If there are the more hardcore elements, the white supremacists and neo-Nazis that go to these rallies that are itching for a fight, we're there to say, we'll stand in your way.
That's from the CNN report yesterday about the Antifa movement. I haven't seen this kind of violence since the 1960s. Here is a movement that's gained prominence through violence. And you notice early on in that clip how the reporter very diplomatically says, well, now, you know, some people will push back and say that the black bloc is to keep people from being arrested when they break the law. Well, that's true, the response came. That's true. And then the CNN also gives them the benefit of the doubt by saying, well, they're also trying to conceal their identities so that they're not spotted by the white nationalist groups or the white supremacist groups. So they have to conceal their identity. They have to wear black masks. But you listen to what they say. It's so that they can break the law. It's so that they can be violent. CNN says Antifa is impossible to track and speed. Well, it talks about just how difficult it was to put together that video. There are people, this is from CNN, there are people who are energized by Bernie Sanders that now are anarchists, said an organizer of the website. It's going down, a news blog for Antifa. It's going down. .org, I believe it is. People are freaked out by a Trump regime, freaked out by the far right. A lot of people saw neo-Nazi symbols. There's a reason why people are becoming polarized. It's real life stuff that's happening. I mean, that's quoting from the Antifa member who sponsors this website. It's going down. And they've gone from getting a few hundred hits every day to 10,000 and 40,000 hits on its best day. On Friday, we sent out a trumpet brief just drawing attention to that New York Times piece from Friday, spotlighting this movement that's been energized by the election of Donald Trump. And they make no bones about it. We're here to confront, to physically confront the white nationalists on the street. What they're doing requires a physical response. And you'll recall, as I said on Friday's program, we're willing to, if this escalates to gunfights, we'll be there with guns. You need violence in order to protect nonviolence. That was a quote in the New York Times on Friday. Well, going back to this, it'sgoingdown.org. I quoted from this in the trumpet brief. I mean, I just mainly went through the New York Times piece on Friday's program. But then it was later on in the day when I was starting to write a few things for the trumpet brief when I was going through the New York Times article and accidentally clicked on the hyperlink that's there in the article to itsgoingdown.org. And there, I should have read this first, but there you can read right from the Antifa site itself. The member that says, hey, I fought against them in Charlottesville. Donald Trump says that there was violence on both sides. Of course there was. Of course there was, say the Antifa members. The media won't let Mr. Trump getting away with saying something like that, even though it's the truth. But here are the Antifa members saying, of course there was violence on both sides. I'm proud of it. I held my own. And then it says this at the Antifa website. Donald Trump was elected head of state through the democratic process, of course, as was Adolf Hitler. He has the support of millions of people. So did Adolf Hitler. His government is in bed with people who dream about carrying out a second Holocaust and reinstating slavery, among other things. This Antifa member writes, we have every right to topple this government if we can. It's not about concealing their identity because of a ragtag group of skinheads. It's about bringing down the government. It's about bringing down law enforcement officials. Back to the CNN report from yesterday, it says Antifa activists often don't hesitate to destroy property. Further on, it says they meet violence with violence. On social media, many of the arrestees have posted anti-police messages and anarchist views. Some write that they feel disenfranchised in the current political climate. They have no voice. They have nothing else to do in response to Donald Trump except take to the streets. And so really, really the whole point of what I've been trying to get across this past week is, of course, there's extremes on both sides. But what movement is more dangerous? And furthermore, what does your Bible prophesy regarding the internal sickness of the United States even before the Great Tribulation begins? Dinesh D'Souza sent out a tweet yesterday. Antifa is more dangerous than the ragtag skinheads and KKK because Antifa has the backing of powerful leftists in politics and media. It's a growing movement. Tens of thousands in Boston. Or at least tens of thousands who decided to show up in support of those on the far left. And it has the support and the backing of the leftists in politics and media. This is a movement that's seeking to normalize political violence, to justify political violence. And you can see pretty prominent and powerful voices in the media that are out there defending its behavior. Here's an example from a Dartmouth professor. This was on, I think, NBC just yesterday, one of the roundtable shows on Sunday morning, clip number 3.
I think that a lot of people recognize that when pushed, self-defense is a legitimate response to white supremacist and neo-Nazi violence. And, you know, we've tried ignoring neo-Nazis in the past. We've seen how that turned out in the 20s and 30s. And the lesson of history is you need to take it with the utmost seriousness before it's too late. We've seen the millions of deaths that have come from not taking it seriously enough. And we can see that really the way that white supremacy grows, the way that neo-Nazism grows, is by becoming legitimate, becoming established, becoming everyday, family-friendly, wear khakis instead of hoods. And the way to stop that is what people did in Boston, what people did in Charlottesville. Pull the emergency brake and say, you can't make this normal.
The way to stop it is with what they did in Boston and Charlottesville. You got to show up and meet force with force. This is coming from a Dartmouth professor on one of the Sunday morning talk shows. He's in a nice suit. He looks sharp. He's written a book. And he's saying, look, they're justified. He went on to say this, clip 4.
Well, let's be clear that Antifa are not calling on the government to censor anyone. In fact, that they resist the notion of turning to the government or turning to the police, who we've seen have been infiltrated by white supremacists, who have been sympathetic to the court, sort of return to law and order notion of fascism. And so the idea is the real enemies of free speech are fascists. We've seen that historically. We've seen that they're the ones that, if they have their way, will shut down speech. And it also differs in the sense that anti-fascists see this as a political struggle. They don't see fascism as a difference of opinion or as kind of a different perspective to consider. Instead, they see fascists as the enemy, and I think that we need to come around to that notion, considering that there is no doubt what they've done historically.
That's on NBC yesterday. They're not looking to the police to help them out here or to solve this problem. They see the police as an institution that's been infiltrated by white supremacists. The police are part of the problem. That's why they're throwing objects at them in Boston. That's why they're throwing bottles of urine at the police. The police are part of the problem. The police who they see have been infiltrated by white supremacists who have been sympathetic to the sort of return to law and order notion of fascism. That doesn't seem to bother anyone in the leftist media, that kind of thinking or ideology. And the most shameful thing about this, that kind of reasoning, is it practically mirrors the argument that a Nazi group would make. And so you have these two extreme movements, and one of them is really expanding, because as Dinesh D'Souza tweeted yesterday, It's got the full backing of a powerful, powerful political machine and media as well. And it goes all the way to the top, the way they see it, the white supremacy, the racism. Listen to what they said yesterday on another one of the Sunday talk shows, this time CNN. Listen to what they said about President Trump, clip 7.
In discussions among friends and family and debates on social media, people are questioning the president's fitness. But these conversations are happening in newsrooms and TV studios as well. Usually after the microphones are off or after the stories are filed, after the paper's been put to bed, people's concerns and fears and questions come out. Is the president of the United States a racist? Is he suffering from some kind of illness? Is he fit for office? And if he's unfit, then what? Is it time for objective journalists? And I don't mean opinion folks. I mean down-the-middle journalists to address these questions head on.
That's Brian Stetler. Pretty amazing. He goes on. He has a roundtable on there. They're all talking about how sick and deranged and racist the current president of the United States is. And later on in the piece, he talks about foreign correspondents saying that there needs to be a coup of some kind in the United States. Just chit-chat on the Sunday morning show. Now, all of this, again, when you think of the prophecies, I brought this out in the Trumpet Brief Friday and also on Friday's program, but when you think of the prophecies in Ezekiel 5 and Isaiah 1, when you consider what Herbert Armstrong said more than 60 years ago about the real aim here from the communist left, you talk about infiltration. Mr. Armstrong was talking about communist infiltration as far back as 1956. Well, even before that. They sabotage our educational system. They wreck our social structure. They destroy America's spiritual and religious life. They weaken America's industrial and economic power. They demoralize the armed forces. And finally, after all this infiltration, they overthrow the government by force and violence. Here they are, openly saying, we are justified in bringing down the entirety of the U.S. government. And the major media is there helpfully encouraging them along. Read again what my father has said in Great Again and America Under Attack. Read what he said. I mean, we're staring this infiltration and this collapse of the U.S. government. We're staring it in the face. Ben Sasse, the U.S. senator from Nebraska, in a Facebook posting over the weekend, he said that it feels like violence is coming. I'm not sure if this moment is like the summer of 1967 or not, but it might be. I mean, it just feels like violence is coming. There was a big enough show of force in Boston, a big enough buffer zone between the two groups, the few dozen on the one hand and the 40,000 on the other hand. But in the end, it was mutually agreed between the few dozen and the police that we better get out of here, because those tens of thousands are barreling down on us. So hop into the police wagons and we'll call it a day. It feels like violence is coming. In fact, you know, Ben Sasse is absolutely right about that. As I said in the Trumpet Brief Friday, look at Genesis 6 and what God said about the days before the flood. The earth was filled with violence. That's where we're headed. In a lot of ways, we're already there. Look at this world. Jesus said, just like in the days before the flood, just like in the days of Noah, that's what we're coming into. And what did God say about those days? He said the earth was filled with violence. Senator Sasse is absolutely right. It is coming. It's all coming before Jesus Christ intervenes to finally solve the problem. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll talk more about the big solar eclipse in the United States of America today. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
To the average person, the idea of an eclipse probably seems like a kind of boring science event that's really only exciting to astronomers. And if you've only ever seen a lunar one, or a partial solar one, then it's easy to wonder what the big deal is. But those who have experienced a total solar eclipse from inside the path of totality know that it is a knee-buckling, awe-inspiring, jaw-dropping, mind-expanding, emotionally overwhelming, and life-altering experience.
That's a little snippet from Jeremiah Jacques' Sun Also Rises program from, I think, 10 days ago. The title of the program, Get Thee to the Path, and I believe the second half of his podcast discusses today's solar eclipse that is going to be especially visible in the United States, all across the country, from Oregon down through to South Carolina. I think Jeremiah was saying it's about a 70-mile swath where you'll really be able to see it, a total eclipse. And he explained there quite eloquently at the end of that clip just how stunning this is. If you get a chance to view that there in the States, I think we'll just see a sliver of it here in the UK, unfortunately. But if you get a chance sometime today, using the appropriate gear, of course, don't go blind. But if you get a chance, hopefully you'll be able to see it or at least see of it on the news, as we'll be watching for over here. At the London Daily Express, it asked the question today, does solar eclipse fulfill Bible prophecy of apocalypse and second coming? That's in today's London Daily Express, and it talks about how there's many fundamentalist Christians who see this as a warning from God. We're coming upon the apocalypse. We're very near to the second coming of Christ and the rapture, which, of course, is nowhere in the Bible. The second coming, of course, is, but not the rapture. But it quotes some of these leading theologians that are sounding the alarm about the events of today. And the first part of this article reveals just how little people truly understand about the Bible. But then notice the second part of this same article. It says, Jeremiah Jacques wrote on thetrumpet.com, it's not just sky watchers who are stirred up about this cosmic occurrence. This eclipse also has numerous religious commentators claiming that it's a sign from God, Jeremiah writes, showing that the last days prophesied in the Bible are now upon us. It quotes Jeremiah further, saying, millions of religiously minded internet users have viewed the videos and read the articles on these topics, and a great percentage of them appear to be totally convinced that these events are of prophetic significance. He says, this spate of doomsday predictions surrounding the August 21st eclipse are only the latest round of attempts by men and women to interpret Bible prophecy. It quotes him further as saying, for untold centuries, individuals have endeavored to predict the future by reading their own meaning into Bible scriptures, but with an abysmal track record. That's the London Daily Express quoting from thetrumpet.com. We reposted Jeremiah's piece today from August the 1st. It's up there at the front page of thetrumpet.com. The Great American Solar Eclipse of August 21st. Is it a fulfillment of Bible prophecy? Does the Bible support the claims of these many so-called prophets? In Jeremiah's article, this is from his article. It's not quoted in the Daily Express. It says, analysts calculate that it will be the most broadly observed, the most carefully studied, the most photographed and filmed eclipse in all of human history. Yet even with all this fanfare and scrutiny, several prominent voices in the religious community say the eclipse deserves far more of the attention of America and the world because it's a warning sign from God. Here again, it's not that Bible prophecy or warnings from God are unimportant, but we've got to make sure that we let the Bible interpret itself. It's not for any man to interpret the meaning of these many prophecies of God. Okay, they can pull a scripture out of context, Joel 2, verse 31. That's in so many of the articles or the statements or the comments by these theologians. The sun shall be turned to darkness, it says in Joel 2, 31. But put that together with so many other prophecies in Daniel, in Matthew, in Revelation. Herbert Armstrong explains it this way in the book of Revelation, Unveiled at Last. He said, here we have three successive world-shaking events to come. First, the Great Tribulation. The Great Tribulation. Second, immediately after the tribulation, the heavenly signs in the sun, moon, and stars. I mean, that's what Joel 2 is talking about. But first, we have the Great Tribulation. And it says then third, following the supernatural signs, it says the terrible day of the Lord. That's from the book of Revelation, Unveiled at Last. So altogether, these world-shaking events, they make up 3.5 years. That's the duration. That's what's talked about in Revelation 12 and verse 14. The first 2.5 years of which Jesus said in Matthew 24, this is going to be the worst conflict and divisiveness and bloodshed and violence that this earth has ever seen in 6,000 years. Jesus said that in Matthew 24, and it's restated in many other Bible passages as well. Daniel 12, Jeremiah 30, Revelation 6. But you've got to get the sequence, and that's what the book of Revelation, Unveiled at Last, does. That's what we base so many of our prophetic explanations on. Exactly what's laid out in the Bible, and we get the proper time sequence. And how sad that amid all the signs that are there, that we're this close to the beginning of the Great Tribulation, that so many people, even in the world of traditional Christianity, are looking even beyond that to the prophesied heavenly signs. But the anarchy that we're seeing on the streets of America, the buildup of a new world power in the heart of Europe, the king of the South in the Middle East, and of course the kings of the East. I mean, these are the areas of the world we need to keep our eyes on. These are signs. Jesus said you can't know the day and hour, but I mean, you can sure know when it's right there, when it's right near the door, you can know. Well, we should at least congratulate the London Daily Express for not only quoting us, but for quoting us accurately, and I think for the most part in context, and quoting a lot from our Trumpet article. It wasn't just this one. On Friday, the Daily Express, this is the London Daily Express, also quoting from another article by Jeremiah, did the Bible predict North Korea starting World War III with the U.S.? What does the Bible have to say about the beginning of World War III? And is this what's happening with North Korea? Is this significant? It says a little ways into the article, analysis from the Philadelphia Church of God claims the danger posed by North Korea is graver than many people realized. Later on, it says, writing for the Trumpet, the news magazine of the church, Jeremiah Jacques indicates any strike could contribute to the wars and rumors of wars that Jesus Christ warned would occur before the Third World War breaks out. End times and the apocalypse have long been linked to possible nuclear war. Here again, it quotes him, his article, at length. It says a little bit later on, Trumpet executive editor Stephen Fleury and managing editor Joel Hilliker said, if nothing else, the mere threat of a mentally unstable tyrant in North Korea using nuclear weapons should cause all of us to be asking some very hard questions. Indeed, we should be asking some hard questions. Rising current nuclear tension should provoke us to consider seriously the biblical prophecies of nuclear destruction. This is what's coming even before the heavenly signs of Joel 2:21. This is what your Bible prophesies. And well, when you look at some of the publicity these articles at thetrumpet.com have gotten, specifically from the London Daily Express, you can see why we had a pretty big spike in traffic at the site. Friday was our biggest day of the year, thanks in large part to this last piece that I went through on North Korea. And then last week was our biggest week yet for the year. So it's nice to see the word getting out and to see new visitors to thetrumpet.com. Hopefully they will continue to visit the site and explore it further, like evidently some of the authors there or the journalists working for the London Daily Express have been doing in recent weeks. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, I didn't quite get to the email feedback, but we'll get to it. Trust me. If you'd like to email the show, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.